Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, the heat in D.C. is making everybody crazy. Oh no, wait, it's the fiscal crisis. That is what is making everybody crazy. The president and the speaker turned to primetime TV to get their message out. Is it still too little, too late? And if at first you don't succeed, form another presidential commission to study the debt crisis. And breaking news out of Capitol Hill, Congressman David Wu of Oregon to resign from Congress. You know it's hot in D.C. when the moderator has to go to Florida to cool off. This is Backroom Politics. Actually, in the nation's capital and here from a remote location, an undisclosed remote location in the heart of Central Florida. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio in a split kind of divisive, almost congressional-esque type manner. We have people spread out throughout the national capital region and throughout the East Coast. I'm your moderator, JT Russell. On the line with me is he is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is also the former floor chief for then-Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome to the show remotely.
Glad to be here, Jason. And Justin, I guess I keep reminding myself another friend. I'm here. I'm ready to go. And it's just as hot here as it has been. And it's the only difference is that it isn't quite 100, the humidity is a little bit down, but it's still damn hot, particularly on Capitol Hill.
Wow, it is very hot. Joining me from an undisclosed location in the National Capital Region, he is the Director of China Programs and the Vice President of Business Development for the Eurasia Center. He is a bar-certified attorney in Washington, D.C. and the great state of New York. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, are you there?
I'm here. Glad to be on with everybody today.
Well, we appreciate you appreciate you calling in on this one. It's a remote one. Congressman Al Swift is out in the hinterland somewhere. We'll try and get him at the break. But it is a busy, busy time here in Washington, D.C., as everybody knows. The first news that we're going to go to is breaking news out of Washington, D.C., out of Capitol Hill. And that is a longtime member of Congress, Congressman David Wu out of Oregon, has announced his resignation after allegations came forward of inappropriate behavior on his part to the minor daughter of a staffer. This is all, of course, allegations. These are, the information still coming in on that. But this is the second member of Congress in a couple of months to be brought down by inappropriate behavior. When we look at this and we look at some of the trends that are going on, Bob, I got to ask you, at some point you would think that a member of Congress, especially after seeing the what happened to Congressman Wiener out of New York, that members of Congress, if they were doing stupid stuff before, they would think that, well, maybe I need to tone down the stupid stuff. That doesn't seem to be happening here, Bob. Why is that? What's not getting through to them?
Well, first of all, I would speculate that this is all it is, that this is probably something that didn't happen the last couple of weeks. So it may have happened a little bit earlier. But the problem is that Capitol Hill is a place where people work very hard, long hours. They are very busy. They think that a lot. They're in a world that is kind of a special place. Everybody says, you know, you're a congressman. You know, I want to talk to you. I'm a constituent. I'm a voter. I'm a lobbyist who works, who, you know, comes from an industry in your district. We all want to talk to you. We all want to pay you obeisance. We all want to, you know, help you get along. We want to vote for you and all this kind of thing. And it's a little bit like people saying, you know, gee, you know, I'm really a pretty important person. And that's a very dangerous attitude to have when a whole bunch of people just like you are around you thinking the same way. And it makes it easy for people to sometimes, you know, do something they wouldn't do in a normal lifestyle.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting to me, at least, that, you know, when we look at, you know, when we look at everything that's going on, when we see the, you know, the scrutiny that a member's private life is. I mean, we're at a point right now where we've never seen that type of scrutiny of a member of Congress. Obviously, the 24-hour news cycle has something to do with that. But is this new, Bob? This type of scrutiny that we're seeing, the type of almost tenacity that the press is going after the personal lives of some of these members?
Well, it's certainly true that there are more scrutineers with more immediate access to immediate transmission of information or speculation. I mean, Twitters and all these electronic, you know, devices that people can go back and forth with each other on, and it is also true that to some degree people forget that they're out there and forget that there's many more ways than, let's say, word of mouth, one person to another, or, you know, talking to a reporter to get stories out. It's so much easier to do it now on all this electronic media, and I think a lot of some of the older generation and a lot of members of Congress are not particularly young, may not be up to date on some of this. Look at, you know, example, you mentioned Mr. Weiner. The reason he got in trouble is because he thought he was sending some information to one person, and he sent it all over. He made a mistake on his machine.
Oh, that's true. Joining us on the phone right now, I believe, is the 8-term member of Congress from Washington's 2nd Congressional District, Congressman Al Swift. Al, are you on with us?
I am on with you, and you're not having feedback problems, I assume.
Doesn't sound like it. Doesn't sound like it.
Good. So good.
What
we sound
got
perfect,
now,
Al.
What?
Good to have
sound
you on,
just
Al.
Great.
Oh, thank you, Ron. You're there too. Okay, good.
So, Al, we were talking about the breaking news coming out of Capitol Hill, and that's Congressman David Wu announcing his resignation after the allegations of inappropriate behavior with a minor. With the minor child of a staffer, and I had asked Bob, but you as a former member of Congress, Al, I've got to ask you. We're seeing a lot of scrutiny on members of Congress, and as a former member of Congress, do you feel like the scrutiny is worse now than it was when you were a member, or is this something? Is this a good thing to maybe keep everybody in check?
I haven't seen. Now, clearly, the scrutiny is much closer than it was when I was in Congress, and particularly years before I was in Congress, where there were well-known drunks and womanizers and what have you in the Congress, but they were never covered. So, yes, more scrutiny. I can't think of too many instances, however, in which the revelations that have been brought about have not been justified. I haven't seen them just picking up on a congressman in order to get a story. So I think probably all in all, the scrutiny is a good thing.
But
well, and I don't think David Wu would have resigned if there wasn't something of substance to these allegations. I don't think he could have defended his actions. So he made the smart decision to just resign and avoid continued unwanted publicity.
Well, from what I've heard, he has quite a little record on this. Now, Bob and I both know a former member from Illinois, that's as specific as I'll get, who was a notorious womanizer. but he retired before this kind of scrutiny caught up with him.
Yeah, and in those days, Al, you're right. The reporters probably knew about it, but they didn't talk about it in their articles or on television programs.
I think that's absolutely true. No, the reporters knew all about these things, but in those days, the reporters defined their jobs as dealing with the public business. And now they have whether you like it or not, they have a broader view of their responsibility, and it's also to report on apparently the actions and morals of public officials.
Well, you know, it's funny, you know, as we look at literally the announcement is no more than a couple of hours old, but already the race has already begun. The names that are starting to pop up include the State Labor Commissioner, Brad Avakian, State Senator Suzanne Bonamici. These are all people whose names, literally, the ink on the story isn't even dry yet, and they're already lining up for this special election. I believe, and Bob, Al, you may know better than I, it's 80 days after the official resignation, is that correct, or is that a state-by-state issue?
It's a state-by-state issue. I don't know how soon the election has to be held, but there are, in every state, there are laws that in effect say when a seat becomes open in the Congress, there are so many dates, you know, so many days until the primaries and then the generals. So it'll be a relatively short time, but it'll probably be months rather than weeks.
Al, does it surprise you that there's already people starting campaigns literally a couple of hours after the announcement? Or is this something that they've been planning the second the news broke about the congressman?
Well, I don't know. The congressman was reported to be in some trouble re-election, which prompts others to, you know, begin considering whether or not they would take him on in a primary or a general election. So it may well be that these were people who were already thinking about it and decided to move quickly. But that's just conjecture on my part.
Well, you know, we're going to see. I mean, this is going to be a race, obviously, that's going to move forward fairly rapidly. Bob or Al, in your experience, do you think that the resignation came as a result of similar actions that they took on Congressman Wiener? Whereas he fought, I mean, up until just this morning, Congressman Wu was talking about he was not going to resign, that he would be vindicated of these charges. But it sounds like Nancy Pelosi had started hearing procedures on it, ethics hearings procedures on it, and there was even talk about stripping him of all of his committees. Is that enough pressure to get somebody to resign? I pose it to Bob.
Yeah, I think so, and I think he did the right thing. I think this is the second member of the House on the Democratic side, and I might add, as a Republican, that we have our equal opportunity offenders. But this is the second one in just a couple of months, and I think Ms. Pelosi, quite rightly, and I'm sure other leadership members must have felt the same way, that they have to lance this boil as soon as quickly, get it behind them as they can, because it is an embarrassment to the party. It's an embarrassment to the Congress as a whole.
Al, do you agree with Bob as far as the actions of Minority Leader Pelosi moving forward on hearings? And is stripping him of his committees enough of a push to move him to resignation?
I would think so. It would certainly make his reelection even more problematical than it already was.
And it gives Democrats a good opportunity to win in the special election.
Yeah, I'm sorry,
well,
Bob, go ahead.
It's a pretty Democratic district, so it's probably going to be a Democrat, whoever gets it.
But Al, you agree with the actions that Pelosi took on this? You think that was the right track, or should they have?
She is protecting the party. And I think probably Boehner would have done the same thing in order for it not to become a charge that the other side can use. But one of the things I'd like to mention, I think that people need to realize that people elect the 535 members of Congress. And people don't always make wise choices. I think you also need to keep in mind that out of 535 people, there's going to be X number of gays, X number of people who are slow pays, X number of wife beaters, X number of what, you know, just the Congress does tend to reflect the body politic as a whole, and that's the good and the bad as well. So it's not that the Congress has suddenly turned corrupt. It's just that the additional scrutiny is finding more of what's probably always been there.
Well, let me ask this final question, because, you know, we hear comments, and I'll pose this to you, Al, as a former member. You know, when we hear the conversation of, you know, they don't want to be a distraction to the party, how much of a distraction is a situation like this to you as an individual member and to the party as a whole in getting its agenda through the halls of Congress?
I don't think it's that huge. The problem is really electoral problems rather than legislative problems. If the party doesn't move against people who are accused of flagrant things and pretty well convicted of flagrant things, that can become the kind of embarrassing question that every candidate can be asked on the stump. What did you do when you found corruption in your party? That kind of thing. And on the stump, that can be very difficult.
Right. All right. Well, we're coming up on our first break, everybody. We're going to put you all on hold. Stay with us. This is Backroom Politics in a somewhat divided Congress mentality. I am broadcasting remotely from Florida. We've got our usual gang of political insiders distributed throughout the national capital region. But needless to say, this is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. And we're back. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. Normally, we would be broadcasting from the smoke-encrusted nerve center of Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, which, to the best of my knowledge, Congressman Al, you're the only one broadcasting live from Shelley's today.
I am at Shelley's, loyal as ever.
Well, thanks for holding down the fort for us, Al.
Al, if I knew you were going to be there, I thought you were going to be at home. If I knew you were going to be there, I'd have come to join you.
Wow.
If you'd ever read your email, you would have known that I was going to be here.
Al, I look at my computer once a week if I have to.
Yeah, and then it's because your eternal search for the on-off switch, you know.
Oh, there's
How
that.
How did you guess?
There
Anyone
we go.
Still there with you, Al?
Okay. Anyway, let's continue on with the discussion here. The discussion's obviously got to turn to the discussion that we've had for just about every week for the past 2 months, and that continues to be the discussion on the fiscal crisis. We are now literally within weeks of a possible debt ceiling hit. We are within days of a possible default, the first time in American history that we would default on our financial obligations. And depending on who you talk to, it's either going to be a hiccup or it's going to be the collapse of the free market economy as we know it. Somewhere in between seems to be where the reality sits. But let's talk about what happened last night. For those who basically have been living under a rock, if you don't know, last night the President of the United States, Barack Obama, turned to primetime TV to get his message out. And literally 2 minutes after he went to clear, Speaker Boehner was on right after him. Literally within 2 minutes, he had primetime airways. And I got to give him credit. They did it all within between 9 and 9:30. It wasn't stretched out, drawn out rhetoric. But it was rhetoric nonetheless, at least. And this is the question to everybody. Ralph, I'll start with you. Did you see this as being just strict rhetoric, straight along party lines?
Well, I think both Obama and Boehner have really competing plans and different ideologies in terms of how they want to deal with this issue of raising the debt limit. The key right now is that the markets are confident America is going to do the right thing at the end of the day. But what has to happen is Republicans and Democrats have to lift the threat of default from the American economy over the next 18 months. And the quality of savings that is offered and the reforms that are put in place are going to be the key. If you don't have those reforms in place and you don't have the savings, that is going to really hurt confidence in the U.S. economy.
But now, Al, when you saw the remarks last night, you have to start to at least see that any sort of forward progress we were seeing in compromise has just been blown out of the water. Or do you think that they left the door open enough for some compromise?
Well, I think the door has a slight crack in it. My sense was that the president used this as, because his position tends to be leading in the polls, even among some Republicans. And I think he thought this would be a good opportunity to try to nail down some loyalty on the part of citizens who believe that way. Boehner, of course, had to have, quote, equal time, end quote, and he was trying to persuade the people that the Republican view was the best one. So in that sense, it was partisan, but I didn't see it as essentially the Democrats and the Republicans arguing about being Republicans and Democrats. I think they were arguing about the policies, and as such, I thought it was fairly useful. But it was also each one trying to convey their idea of what had gone on and what needs to be done. Certainly wasn't a dialogue in which they were trying to resolve a problem.
Well, let me, Bob, let me ask you this question. I mean, when we talk about the dialogue, I mean, do you think that there's still any dialogue that's available to anybody at this point, or is the rhetoric just taken over?
Well, it strikes me that where the two plans that have been proposed, one by the Speaker and one by Mr. Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, are relatively similar in the amount of savings they develop. Neither one of them have much to do about tax enhancements or, you know, reducing some of the tax expenditures. It's strictly a cutting factor. They're both approximately the same, and they both have as an inducement for further development of developing a program of further cuts. They both create committees of the Congress who are supposed to, you know, report back to their bodies and to try to break, try to, you know, increase the level of savings. The biggest difference is that Mr. Boehner says that he is going to, he wants another vote next year on whatever the committee the committees decide, and the president and Mr. Reid want to have the committee report after the election because they don't want to have another vote on this before the election next year, and I can certainly understand that. The thing that makes me most unhappy is what I think, and this is what I believe, what I've read in the tea leaves about what happened over the last weekend when Mr. Boehner called up and said, when I guess the president said to Mr. Boehner, they had basically an agreement of about $2.5 trillion in savings, and about $800 billion in of tax enhancements, you know, some of the reduction of some of the tax expenditures that we now have in our tax code. And it was I gather 800 was the number there. And I gather the president came back to Mr. Boehner and said, I've got to have 400 more because I can't get it past my party. And Mr. Boehner goes back and says to the president, hey, I'm lucky I can get 800 to go with my guys, go with 800. I can't take any more.
Yeah,
what happened here was that we could have had a deal between the two principals, but the Democrats wanted more and the Republicans couldn't accept more. So, you know, there we are. We're back to square one. Hopefully, the fact that the two proposals currently on the table by Mr. Boehner and Mr. Reid will be able to find some middle ground. The difference is important. I mean, Mr. Boehner is saying we're going to have a short term. We're not going to go for, you know, another year and a half of this stuff. We're going to get down to business quickly. And the administration and Mr. Reid want to put it off until after the election.
Yeah, but Al, when we look at all everything coming out of the Boehner camp, and then we look at the president's response on this, the president's response actually, you know, the creation of another commission. Does it look like that he's backtracking a little bit? Does it look like that – does this actually help the Republican stance by him creating, quote-unquote, another commission?
I don't know. We'll have to look at the next poll. I think – and I'm going to say something now that may be very controversial among our colleagues, and I am not saying this because I think I'm a spokesman for the president or for the Democratic Party, but rather what I truly believe. It seems to me that the Democrats in the Senate and at the White House have gone farther than many Democrats think they should have, and have gone farther than I have ever seen a ruling party go to try and reach an accommodation. And I think when the president said, is there anything to which the Republicans will say yes, it was a legitimate question. I think that the Republicans are behaving in a totally unprecedentedly stubborn way, and the problem is that there's an enormous amount at stake for the economy as they do that.
But when we look at when we look at enormous stakes in the economy, Ralph, I go to you. Last night, everybody was talking about having to get a deal in place by Sunday afternoon because they were worried about the impact on the opening of the Asian markets. Asian markets open up, and it's literally a hiccup. The Nikkei was maybe down a few percentage points, but nothing that is unusual on the daily course of business. Why do you think that the Asian markets aren't just tanking right now, especially after the rhetoric we heard last night?
Well, I think they still have confidence, as I said, that at the end of the day, America is going to do the right thing. What we have to look at is and recognize is that the S&P will downgrade the U.S. Credit rating if the U.S. puts together a deal that just basically kicks the can down the road. You have to have a viable long-term plan that will raise the debt ceiling in order for the markets to feel comfortable in the long run with the U.S. economy. So we're going to have to figure out what deal is passed to see if that is something that really addresses the issue over the long term or if it's some sort of short-term fix. If it's a short-term fix, the international markets are going to react very adversely.
Wow. Al, when the rhetoric is still there, if we keep hearing the rhetoric about how this is going to impact the global economy, and listening to what Ralph just said, doesn't this possibly come across as just one large presence of Congress being a drama queen, for lack of a better term?
Well, I don't think the Congress has been queenly in any respect, frankly. they're sitting up there, and frankly, as far as the House Democrats are concerned, I don't see where they've contributed anything. Maybe they haven't been asked to. I don't know. Maybe they haven't been led into the table. But I see the fact that you've got so many new members, the Tea Party people, who honestly do not understand how things work and why these things have been handled more easily in the past, basically don't understand the need, the essentiality of compromise in a democratic society. And I think that's where the blame. Boehner is behaving in a very un-Boehner-like way.
Bob,
but he's running as fast as he can to stay ahead of his right wing.
Bob, do you agree with that?
Not quite, no, I don't. As I said earlier, I think Boehner and the president pretty well had a deal going, and the president came back and asked for $400 billion more of revenue, and Boehner had a hard enough time getting the $800 billion that he and the president had worked out. And I think what happened was that some of the Democrats, and I think Al is exactly right, the Democrats have moved farther than I think many people would have thought. I think Al's exactly right. It was amazing what the president was able to get them to do, but apparently they gulped and they wanted some more, and he came back and asked for some more and said he had to have it, and Boehner said, I can't give it to you because I can't get it out of my guys. And I think it's fair to say that we do have a situation, as Al just indicated, we have a lot of people who are relatively new to Congress, feel very strongly on the Republican side about getting the smaller government and getting deficits under control, and it's awfully hard for them to see that they ought to be giving any more than Boehner offered.
Well, let me.
And
ask,
I know
but,
that was
but
hard to do. So the fact of the matter is, I suspect that you've got a situation where the Democrats say they need a certain level and they won't go any farther. They have to have so much. Republicans say the same thing, and the middle just isn't there.
But Bob, when and I pose this to both Bob and Al, this strikes me as a situation where we look at the 80 new members, the 80 new freshmen coming in that are mostly aligned with the Tea Party. It strikes me that this could be a lot of power, a lot of quick. That this is that they really haven't truly figured it out how Washington truly works. That that they're more a hindrance to the process than they are actually helping their constituents on an individual basis. Is that an accurate viewpoint, or is that somewhat jaded?
Well, I of course think it's accurate. What I think you have is a bunch of people who you can argue or not with their positions. I obviously would disagree with their position, but what they don't know is, I want to state this properly, they don't know how to get it done. And I think an experienced ultra-conservative would say, man, you had a real deal there, much bigger than anyone could have expected. And what you should have done is grabbed it and stuck it in a drawer. And otherwise, you run the risk of losing and causing a lot of havoc. So I think I'm not accusing them of ignorance in policy. I'm accusing them of not knowing how to achieve their policy goals.
Yeah, but Bob, you would think though that even if half of this 80 some odd members had professional staffs that had spent any time on the Hill prior, that they would have staffers that would at least help them navigate. Are we missing the boat on that, or should there be staffers saying, look, boss, this is how it gets done?
Well, we are doing the show right now.
You know,
but,
yes,
but,
you know,
it's just
it is
so
true
light.
That I think a lot of them have probably, I'm sure a lot of them have hired some of the professional staff from Washington. But, you know, any time you get such a large percentage of the majority party, I mean, literally one-third of their 250 members or 255 members are new, they're freshmen. If you bring that much of a new group in, particularly in a very after a campaign which was very very divisive, I mean, we were jobs and the problems of the economy were first foremost 1, 2, 3 issues. That was what they cared about, the public cared about. And you had an awful lot of people who ran for office who had not run, who were not, let's say, they weren't state representatives or senators in their state legislature. They weren't county commissioners or mayors. And you had an awful lot of people.
Can I interrupt you for just a moment?
Here
at Chili's, the smoke-encrusted bar, the owner, Bob, has just come in and asked me if I could move into the other room because he had denied a group this room. And then, because I'm the only one sitting in it, he'd like to let him come in. So you might lose me as I make the transfer, and at the next break, we can reconnect.
You know what, Al? You know what we're going to do is, Al, we're going to reconnect. We're going to disconnect you right now, and then what we'll do is we'll reconnect you after the break. How's that?
Well, yes, and my apologies to Bob, because I think what he was saying was important.
Yes, not a problem, not a problem. We're going to disconnect you right now. We'll call you back after the break. But, Bob, going back on to your – I want you to finish that thought, because that's an interesting take.
You know, the fact of the matter is there have been at least two or three elections like this where you had the new majority in the House, particularly the House, you know, is becoming a huge percentage of the majority caucus. And when they come in fresh, new, excited, eager to do what they said they were going to do, they are more enthusiastic than they are knowledgeable about the way you get things done in Washington. And Al touched on that point. It's important to understand that, you know, you can have all the fervor in the world, you can have all the truth in the world you believe in, but you still have to be able to maneuver through the rapids, if you will, of the congressional policy-making structure. And it was set up this way by the founding fathers deliberately to, in effect, try to make sure that legislation, as it moved through the Congress, was well vetted, well-structured and solve the problem in the best way possible from a legislative and policy standpoint. So you can understand how these new people coming in, brand new, they've only been there, you know, basically 6 months, and they are trying to achieve what their goals are, and it's hard for them to understand that sometimes you got to bend a little bit more than you might want to. They've already bent a good bit.
I think
that the fact that they've been asked to that last $400 billion that the president wanted was beyond what they could bend. The president's view was that he couldn't bend, that he had to bend to his people to get another $400, and the Republicans said we can't bend anymore. So, you know, you had an impasse there. I don't think anybody is at fault for causing a disruption. I mean, we thought we had a deal. I think everybody had a deal, and then the president came back, but he had to come back from his standpoint, but Republicans couldn't take any more.
But Bob, here's my point on this. And any time that I've let me take off my moderator hat and comment. Any time that I've shown up in a new organization, whether I was in the military and I got transferred to a new duty station, whether I was just coming out of an academy and being stationed in law enforcement somewhere, or if I was, you know, showing up at a new job immediately, I always looked around for some sort of mentorship and guidance. And whenever I got that mentorship and guidance, I would try not to make too many waves. I would try and get my sea legs first, then try and find out what's the easiest, best, most effective way that I can be part of an overall solution to get the job done. It strikes me tremendously that we have not seen that type of approach from a lot of the freshmen. They've come in there saying, my constituents elected me for a reason. I am going to be the voice of my constituents. Whether it helps or hampers the effort itself, they go in there and they go in guns a-blazing without knowing what they're aiming at.
But think about it this way, Justin. When you have 20 new members or 25 new members or 30 new members of the majority caucus in the House, which let's say is 240 members, you've got one eighth. When you have 87 out of 250, you've got a third. It's a big difference. You have a lot more people urging you on not to bend too much. That's the problem here. It happens when the Democrats would take over from the Republicans with a big majority. It's now happening when the Republicans take over from the Democrats with a big majority of their caucus.
I think it's important to mention, though, that the House has passed a budget. They passed cut, cap, and balance. And the Democrats have not published any kind of budget. They haven't put together any concrete plan that you can score. So the Republicans have acted, but the Democrats still haven't put all their cards on the table.
Hey, gentlemen, before we get into that discussion, Ralph, I want to bring that up after the break. We're going to take about a 3-minute break. We're going to get Al back on the line because I want Al to be on the line to respond to that because I think that's going to be a good discussion, Ralph. So hold that thought. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. We're almost from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. Stay with us. And we're back live on Blog Talk Radio. This is Backroom Politics, somewhat live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Joining us from Shelley's is Congressman Al Swift. Al, you there?
I am here.
Great. Also joining us from the air-conditioned comfort of his living room is Bob Hines. Bob, you there?
I am.
And joining us from an air-conditioned, undisclosed location somewhere in the National Capital Region is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, you there?
I'm here, ready to go.
Fantastic. Ralph, let's start with you. You had made a comment before the break regarding the Democrats and their lack of offering up suggestions on that. You want to go over that again real quick?
Sure. My point was that the House has passed a budget. They passed cut, cap, and balance. At this point, the Democrats have published no budget whatsoever, nor have they put forth a scoreable plan, which the Republicans have done. At some point, the Democrats have got to start putting their cards out on the table and put together what their view is of a viable budget. This is where we're at right now, and you can agree or disagree with cut, cap, and balance, but at least it's out there on the table. The Republicans have acted, but all the Democrats are doing is reacting to it. They're criticizing it, but they haven't put forth a budget.
Al, what is your take on that? I mean, have the Democrats just been, taking a back seat and waiting to see what comes out of the GOP, or is there a leadership role that the Dems have been playing on this?
I think that, and I said it myself 3 or 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, that what Ralph said is exactly correct. I don't think that's true now. It is true that they haven't published something, but if you're in negotiations, it's best not to publish it. You know, you can't make compromises with everybody looking in on it. So I think the fact that Boehner and the president came as close as they did, and the fact that the Senate is working with Boehner and so forth, all of those have obviously got Democratic input and Democratic suggestions. And keep in mind, this whole game is being played on the Republicans, or actually on the Democrats, part of the field. The Democrats have given up way more ground than the Republicans have. And the proposal that they make was one that at the outset you could tell was going to be unacceptable to the Democrats. So it was not realistic in that sense. It was a good starting point, and I praised Ryan for it at the time. But it was not going to be the final piece, and I think it's unfair to suggest that the Democrats aren't actively working to try and resolve this problem.
And we've got a caller. We've got a caller live on the air. Caller, you're on with Backroom Politics. Caller. And man, that is becoming an absolute pain in the rear end. We just got hit with My Little Pony again. Boom. We got to fix that. When we go back out, when we look at the different proposals that are out there. When we look at the different agendas, now the Senate is saying, you know, both Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell are saying that there's overlap in what the GOP and what the Dems are putting forward. Does that not strike you as saying, well, let's at least start in the middle and work our way outward, or does that just not make sense in political world?
Oh, I think it makes sense. I think it's a little late in the game. As those deadlines bear down on us, it's going to become increasingly difficult to get anything done in time. But yes, I think it shows active work on the part of both the Democrat and Republican leader in the Senate.
Now, Bob, I pose this question to you. This is a question that's I've been asked it a couple of times today, is, you know, it's a routine situation where the president's asked for an increase in the debt ceiling. It's always gone through. President Obama invoked the names of the two great Republicans of the modern era, that being Ronald Reagan and President Bush 43, saying that they did it numerous times unscathed. Is invoking the ghosts of presidents past a good idea at this stage? Is that enough to get Republicans to budge, or are we so dug in that we just can't dig ourselves out?
Well, I don't. I think it's perfectly legitimate to point it out. I mean, it's a political statement by the president, which is a fact, that the budget has been passed. You know, the budget debt ceiling has been increased whenever there has been need for it. And it's the reason it has always been increased when there's a need for it is because every single president in the past has recognized that he had to have an increase because you don't want to have a failure of the United States to pay its bills and to default. Every president has seen that. I think Mr. Obama sees it. This situation has arisen for a very practical and simple reason from a political standpoint. The reality is that from relatively shortly after the president was elected, and we had the stimulus package, we had the economy went into a tailspin before that. He was trying to save it, did a good job in some ways. The fact of the matter is, a lot of people in the country came to the conclusion that the political process in the country was not working. Number one, that there was much too much spending. There was not enough, throttling back of government expenditures, and that issue was what was fought on the election last year. And a whole lot of folks came to Washington, committed to the idea that we were going to have less government, because we couldn't afford the government we had, and it wasn't doing the things that the public wanted to be done. And that reality has caused a little bit of a new paradigm. Good or bad, it's there. And we have to take account of it, and I don't think the president has quite realized, maybe very recently, until very recently, that how serious some of these folks are. Now, I can definitely understand people saying that Democrats have gone farther than they've ever gone in the past. Al is exactly right. They have. And I think they've been made a very fair proposal. I wish the president hadn't come back to Boehner and said, I got to have $400 billion more because I can't get my people. We like everything, but we got to have more. And I think John Boehner, the speaker, said, I've gone as far as I can possibly go with my guys who didn't want to go as far as I was going. The problem is, we can't find a way to bridge that last hurdle because both parties seem to believe that they have gone as far as they can go, and that's a legitimate political judgment, but it's not helping the country.
Yeah, but Al, I hear what Bob's saying, and we see the rhetoric that's going on in the media, but then we get word that the White House has threatened to veto the legislation that's pending in the House. And it's almost like that's a line in the sand for Speaker Boehner. Speaker Boehner's obviously garnering the amount of votes to get it passed in the House and could obviously get it passed in the Senate for the White House to say, we're going to veto if it comes across the desk. Does that show compromise?
Well, if they've already come, and I'm making up these percentages, if the Democrats have already gone 50% of the way to the Republican position or 75% of the way to the Republican position, it boggles my mind to think that this is the Democrats' fault. This is the debt ceiling. They have... I'm sorry, are you trying to get through?
No, go ahead, Al. Keep going.
Okay. They, when I was in Congress, 20 years ago, the debt ceiling was always misunderstood by many, many people as to be the place where you could stop the spending. As the president pointed out the other night, and as we have said on this program, this is just to cover stuff that's already been spent. This is not going to, you know, curtail spending in the future. It will only say that we refuse to pay the debts we've already run up. And that's the reason that so many times in the past, common sense prevailed, and they passed the debt limit ceiling. The big fight, the real fight, is over what are we going to do in terms of cutting the deficit and raising revenues so that this will not happen in the future. That is being neglected while we're sitting around playing as though this was sitting around playing with a debt ceiling rather than when we should be dealing with the budget.
Well, you know, and this also plays into Ralph. Ralph, you know, when we've been down the road of we've come to a conclusion and then we seem to have compromised and then we take five steps back. The concern has always been that every time we see that there's a deal, the markets get lined up, particularly in Asia. Everybody says that the world is right again, and people start going back about business as usual. Is there going to be a time, Ralph, that you see where we've cried wolf so many times that the Asian markets are going to say, look, we just can't trust the U.S. anymore, and sending global markets into a tailspin?
Well, I think it's interesting that it was alleged that Boehner indicated that American jobs and the American economy was not tied into Asia, or that Asia was not important to American jobs and the American economy.
Is that accurate, Ralph?
Well, no, absolutely not. American jobs and the American economy is definitely tied into Asia. That's where the money is coming from. If you look at China and Singapore, they're the countries that have the foreign direct investment. They're the countries that are lending money. A lot of the top financial institutions are coming out of China and Singapore. And my sources have indicated that this debate over raising the debt ceiling has really concerned the Chinese to the point where they're at a very high level are talking with people in the Obama administration and saying, you're going to solve this crisis because we want to get paid. And that's sort of adding more fuel to the fire. I mean, the Obama administration is not going to come out and say this publicly, but certainly the Chinese are very concerned about their investments that they've made in this country and don't want to see the country go into a tailspin because it affects the Chinese investment over here.
So Bob, when we hear the comments of Ralph and we hear that, you know, that even the financial markets, is there a point where even with the American electorate, we're going to be crying wolf on this subject and it's just going to throw everybody into a tailspin?
Well, it's, you know, we have, we have as large economy as anybody in the world, probably larger. We import a huge amount of stuff from overseas. We send a lot of stuff overseas on exports. If we default, can't pay the interest on our bonds, which are owned by certainly every country in Europe and probably every major bank in the world, it's going to have a huge ripple effect. I mean, I think what Ralph says is right, but multiply that, you know, the Chinese may be the ones who would yell the most, and legitimately so. They probably are the largest single sovereign bondholder of the United States bonds, of all the other countries. I mean, there's a lot of countries that are going to all feel the same way because we're in effect failing to pay our obligations, and we've got to do it. All the politics aside, and who shot John, and who's responsible. The fact of the matter is, we have got to pay our darn bills, and we're not in a position to pay them if we don't raise the debt ceiling. And we've got 8 days to do it.
Well,
I mean, you're going to see more countries looking at moving away from the dollar as their form of reserve currency if we do not raise the debt ceiling. And have a long-term approach to dealing with the fiscal issues in our country.
Well, we're going to take a break, everybody, for another 3 minutes. Let's take a 3-minute break. When we come back, I want to talk and I want to focus in on something because I think now's a good time for us to at least address this issue is, you know, we hear both sides talking about compromise, compromise, compromise. And compromise has been the bastion of something that this talk show and our organization, the Frank Conk Society, has been just advocating for years. And yet we hear the word compromise. When we come back, I want to talk about the issue of compromise. Who has compromised? And what do we have to do? Basically, the question I'm going to pose to all of you is Washington broken? And how we fix it? And that should take a couple of shows. But this is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio, usually broadcasting from 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. That's Shelley's Back Room, America's premier cigar tavern. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. And we're back live on Blog Talk Radio. This is Backroom Politics, somewhat live from Shelley's Back Room. Joining us from Shelley's Back Room at 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital is Congressman Al Swift. Al, you still with us? Al?
Yeah, I just came back. I had to go to the bathroom. At 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital.
Joining us Joining us also from an undisclosed location somewhere in the National Capital Region is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, you there?
I'm here. Very excited
okay.
to be
and,
back.
And Bob, please tell me you didn't have to do the same thing that Al just did.
I can't say that.
Oh, God, come on, people. My God, this is a professional show, for crying out loud. Let's get on to a topic that arguably is just as sensitive and probably just as unfortunate, but it's something that we need to talk about, and it's a broad question. Over the weekend, we've heard a lot of the talking head circuit talk about, is Washington broken? Where is the compromise? Where is the organization that we know as Congress? Why are they not able to come to some sort of consensus to start to stave off disaster? So I want to start with a broad question. Number one, Al, I'll start with you, Al. Al, is Washington broken right now?
Washington is on its way to be broken. If we don't resolve the problems that we've just been talking about, I think that it's if it's not going to break it, it's certainly going to rough up considerably. I think that this goes back, however, maybe as far as the Newt Gingrich speakership. The partisan bickering has been going on for a long time. We've seen if the Senate changed hands, where as the Democrat leader goes to fill the Republicans, let me say it this way, as the minority moves itself into the majority office when they take over, and the minority, they basically trade playbooks, and they each take positions that had been the other guy's position before, and so forth on the other side. And I think this bickering, this inability to get things through the Senate, and I pick on the Senate simply because it gets greater coverage, so the public is more aware of the faults there, that the public was getting increasingly disgusted with the inability of Washington to work.
Let's look at something, though. You know, you talk about the Senate, and Bob, I'm going to pose this question to you. It almost seems that there's been a reversal of fortune, whereas the House won't budge. It seems that there's actually consensus building and compromise going on in the Senate. Is that inaccurate?
Well, you know, look, both parties have given stuff. The Senate is probably a little more flexible and certainly more flexible than the House is. But both parties in both houses have given that they put skin in the game, so to speak. And the question is, to me, is how do we find a way to bridge the last, you know, both sides have come a long way. We just have to find a way to get over the last couple of hurdles. And it seems that it's getting, you know, the hurdles either seem to get higher or people get more and more tired of giving. But in any event, whatever happens is it's just getting harder and harder.
Well, Bob, I pose the question to you now. Is Washington broken?
If it hasn't quite broken, it's awfully bent out of shape.
Ralph, I ask the same question. Is Washington broken?
If Congress does not pass the Colombia, Panama, and South Korea free trade agreements, I think you can say the system is effectively broken. Colombia, Panama, and South Korea have been staunch allies and supporters of this country. And to not pass these FTAs would be absolutely impossible.
Al, I want to go back to you for a second. And I want to go back to your comments regarding the Senate and the House. When we see Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid coming together and actually proposing solutions, that's not something we normally see coming out of the Senate. Usually we're blaming the Senate for a lot of the roadblocks that are happening.
That's right.
So when we see the Senate minority and the Senate majority leader going full on in a manner of, dare I say, compromise, do they have enough strength and enough wherewithal to at least help push the agenda through the House and get some sort of equal time compromise in the House of Representatives?
Okay, let's lay the elephant in the room right square in the spotlight. It is the Tea Party people in the House that are the problem. Boehner cannot persuade them, apparently, to make any compromises that will work. And that's not John Boehner's fault. It's the hand he was dealt. But if there's a group that is the primary cause of all of this stalemate, it is the Tea Party people.
Bob, do you agree with that?
Well, I would say this. The Tea Party people are the ones who have been the most steadfast in their views. But, again, I'll go back to what I said earlier. You know, apparently we were in a situation over the weekend where the president asked on behalf of his side of the table for $400 billion more in revenues over and above the $800 that had already been agreed to, and asked for $400 more, and Mr. Boehner came back to him and said, I can't do it because I can't get it out of my people. They've already felt they've given a lot of skin with $800 billion, and $1.2 trillion is more than they can't get over that hump. So
yeah, but Bob,
you know, it that doesn't mean that either side is right. It means that both of them have choking points, and maybe the reason the choking point for the Tea Party is where it is because they haven't been here long enough to understand how the system works, as well as some of the more experienced legislators on both sides of the aisle. And
Ralph,
I think that's a very fair comment.
Ralph, let's go to you. You had a comment?
Yeah, I think the Tea Party is going to say, look, you know, we've acted. We've passed the budget. You know, the Democrats have not come forward with anything concrete. There's been no you can't score a speech that Obama makes railing about what should be a quote budget. They're going to say, look, we've acted. We want to work. We've tried to work with the president, but all he's doing is attacking what we've put forth. We've passed a budget, and it's been defeated on the other side.
I think that's absolutely correct. That is what they would say. I think it is total nonsense.
Why?
They haven't realized why, because they have got more out of this situation than I think currently, the thing that they last turned down, more than they would have in a normal world ever been able to anticipate the dream, and it wasn't good enough. So I just think that they are the sand in the gears, and they may bring the whole machine to a halt.
And I would say that Al is making a very fair statement about the effort that the Democrats have made to come to the table with proposals that I think, as he expressed earlier, and I agree with, that the Democrats have really, you know, gone a long way in with respect to what they were offering, with in order to get a grand deal. A big deal, and I think that is fair to say. They did a real good job of sucking it up and trying to go as far as they could go, and they went as far as they could go. And then, you know, something happens because the House Republicans, you know, are newer. We all know it, and they're having troubles getting used to the rhythm and the ways of Washington. They're new to it, and they're having trouble. They came up here with an agenda that the public gave them because they ran on a program, and the public said, we like you, we like what you're saying, we're going to vote for you, and they voted them in. And they come up here, most of them were not legislators in the past, and they're having It's a process to have them move off their quote principles unquote. It's hard for them to move off the positions that they have taken back home to their voters and modify them. Boehner has given them three or four votes on bills that did not pass the House, passed the Senate. They passed the House but not the Senate, and those bills he tried to give them some flexibility to say, look, we've done everything we can possibly do. We can't get it past the Senate. We got to have more people like us down here, and that's where they are. And they're having a hard time moving beyond what they've already done.
But we look at
got them to move pretty far, but they can't get as far as the gap between what the Democrats feel they can do when they have moved very far.
Yeah, but Bob, you look at somebody like Tom Coburn. You know, Tom Coburn, who, in my opinion, has been trying to work compromise out in everything that he's done. He's obviously got a close relationship with the president. He came back to the Gang of Six when asked. It seems like, you know, there's got to be a focal point, particularly in the big house in the Senate, that says, look, okay, kids, you're playing at the adult table now. There are certain things, in order for Washington to work, things have to be done a certain way. We understand that you've made your pitch, you've made your scene. It's almost like that the Tea Party Republicans are throwing a temper tantrum, if you will, regarding this whole idea of a debt crisis.
I would say this. I don't disagree with that. I think Tom Coburn is an example of the kind of legislator that is needed more and more in the Senate and in the House than we have it today. He has moved a great. He is a true statesman right now, in my view. And there are a lot of I think Kent Conrad is another one. It's fair to say that the Tea Party people are having a real hard time, and I'm not defending the Tea Party people. I'm trying to explain where they're coming from, because I think there are real serious problems. We have to find a solution to this, and we have a very short time to do it, and that means that everybody maybe has to suck it up a little bit more than they've been willing to suck it up already. Both sides have moved a long way. Maybe they both moved, let's say, 45% of the way they have to move. They probably both have to move 5% more, and maybe it's choking both of them, but they're going to have to do it.
Al, go ahead.
One of the things that, you know, we have said, Bob said it, you've said it, I've said it, maybe Ron has said it, and that is that they don't understand how things work here. Now, their response to that would be, we came here to stop business as usual, to stop the way Washington, D.C. works. And I can understand their frustration. But what I think they fail to understand is that government is made up of people. If you look at American politics, it reflects so much how individuals, in fact, behave in our social exchanges and so forth and so on, that, in fact, compromise is a fundamental part of family life. It's a fundamental part of the Kiwanis Club, the local union, and so forth, because you cannot have freedom for everybody to believe what they want and act on it and get anything done if you are unwilling at some point to compromise so you can move ahead, because you have so many different views of what should be done. So I think if they say, well, we don't want to do it the way it's always been done, then they better figure out how to change human nature, because Washington, D.C.'s faults and its strengths both grow out of human nature, and what the Tea Party people are asking for is some kind of perfection as they define it, and that just won't work in a human institution.
This discussion we're having now, and I think you hear frustrations, the audience must hear frustrations in all our voices, that there isn't a solution here. One of the things we may want to do in the future, after this problem is resolved, Justin, is have a program where we talk about some of the basic principles of the First Congress Society, where we all understand, as the Founding Fathers created this great place that we live in, the United States.
Now, you know what?
The system,
Bob,
is made up of compromises, and everyone has to understand that nobody gets it all. We have to give way to the greater good of the greater body.
Now, I agree with you on that, Bob. And Bob, that's definitely something I think we're going to do here. We may even do that next week, on next week's show. But I will tell you right now, you know, I gave a speech at Georgetown last week, and there was almost an underlying consensus with all of these, you know, future politicians and future lawyers and future businessmen. You know, a lot of the infrastructure when it comes to people we look at comes from the colleges such as George Mason, Georgetown, American University. So the bottom line here is, what I'm trying to say is, I got the consensus from the young people that they feel that Washington is in fact too much inside baseball. They have a problem understanding the whole idea of, you know, we can't change it overnight, and people get frustrated because they can't change it overnight. People get this idea of it's got to happen. It's not happening quick enough for me. And that creates complacency. That creates almost disenfranchisement. And we're seeing a lot more of that in the groups that we want to see help at least gradually fix the problems that are in Washington. My problem with the Tea Party has been from the get-go is that these freshmen come up here thinking that they're going to change the world overnight. They're not going to be able to change anything. You know, we've gotten to this point because successfully, 200 plus years, we have had Congresses that have been seated. This is what, the 112th Congress? You know, for 111 Congresses, it's been successful. And we've actually got a caller on the line. Hold on for a second. Caller, you're on the air. 203 caller.
He's sitting next to me, and he says that he has just walked in, and he doesn't know what we're talking about yet, so he's going to hang on, and maybe we'll kick in a little bit later.
Okay, is that the 203 area code?
No.
All right, hold on.
Yeah, he's 703, and he's a very knowledgeable guy, so give him a chance to hear what the
okay.
What's the conversations about?
We've got another caller on the line. 203, you're on the air.
I just called in to listen.
I'm sorry. Okay, that's fine.
I just called in to listen.
Thank you for listening. We'll put you back on hold.
Justin, I wanted to just make a point. I think everything that you and Bob and Alice said is valid. I think the president has repeatedly said he's will not sign a deal that only allows a temporary increase of the debt limit. He wants the debt limit to be raised through 2013. But if you listen to what Coburn has said, President Obama may have no choice but to do a temporary increase of the debt limit because of his inability to get the Republicans and the Tea Party on board.
Well, right now it looks like, you know, we say that the ball's in the president's court, the ball's in the House's court. Right now, the ball's at center court. Somebody's going to have to pick up the ball and move forward on this if we want to see success here in the future. But Bob, I agree with you. I think that next week would be a fine time, because if we haven't gotten to a point here or there in Washington, me being down in Florida, if we haven't gotten to a point where we have seen some deal that has thwarted off the possibility of default, if we haven't gotten to that point by next week, we're going to have to figure out why Washington is so broken anyway. So I think that's a great idea, Bob. When we come back, we've got another half hour left. We're going to talk a little bit about what happened in Norway over the weekend and the possibility of homegrown terrorism in the United States. And then we'll go into our Tell Me a Story segment. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. At least Al's broadcasting from 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Shelley's Back Room. This is Blog Talk Radio's Backroom Politics. Stay with us.
I have forgotten his name.
Radio. At least Al is broadcasting from Shelley's back room. Al, you still at Shelley's?
I'm still at Shelley's.
And there's still a crowd there. That's good to know. Good to know. Joining us also as we finish up the show this week, Bob Hines, Ralph Winnie, still with us?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm here.
Good, good. I want to talk about something not as pleasant, obviously. It's a serious subject, but I thought it needed to be discussed. It's being discussed widely through Washington circles as well as other circles, and that is the tragic events that happen in Norway. The reason why I wanted to bring it up is because it begs a very large question here in the United States as well. But just to recap what happened in Norway, a 32-year-old Norwegian who considers himself a warrior, a gentleman by the name of Anders Behring Breivik, 32, was arrested after a bomb he created went off outside the Prime Minister's offices there in Oslo. After that went off, he dressed up as a policeman and went to Utøya Island, where there is a summer camp being run by the Labour Party. When he arrived on the island, he killed 8 people and then instantly started shooting 68 people, mainly youngsters, at this youth camp there on Utøya Island. All in all, over 80 people were killed by, for no other term, this maniac. It's something that drew international condemnation, but it brings up two very important questions, and I wanted to pose this to the table. Is when you guys heard about this, the first explosion at the Prime Minister's offices in Oslo, and then the shooting rampage, did you think that there was a Muslim group behind it, Bob?
Well, I didn't catch it really quickly afterwards, so I'd already heard about this individual. And I had heard that he was a, I guess you would call him a very conservative, almost fascist Nazi type individual, and was worried about Leninism and Muslim spreading influence and whatnot. And I thought to myself, well, he sounds like just one crazy individual. Now, I haven't heard enough since then to know anything different than that, but that was what I thought I heard when I first heard it. And in one sense, as horrible as it was, just a terrible experience. And I can't imagine how Norway must feel, which is a country which has probably not had anything like this happen, as devastating as this, since the Nazis invaded them in 1940. I mean,
well, you know, it's funny.
It's stunning.
It
seems to me that, in one sense, as bad as it is, it may be not as bad as it could be. It may not indicate that there's some group of people like that who are engaged or are going to be engaged in a continuing series of trouble, doing things of this kind in other places at other times on a continuing basis. This may just be one crazed, very unfortunately deranged individual.
Al, the reason why I asked this question to Bob and Al, I wasn't sure if you had heard it as it was happening over the weekend, if maybe you thought that when you initially heard about an explosion in front of the Prime Minister's offices in Oslo and then a shooting rampage on a political retreat, basically. The reason why I asked, do you think it was Muslim, there was Al-Qaeda involvement. I asked you the question, did you, when you first heard it, did you think about the explosion being caused by Al-Qaeda?
No, I didn't. Now, I heard about it a little bit after it occurred. And by that time, the media, to their credit, had pretty well indicated it was probably a single person and domestic. So I didn't get hit with it right smack in the face.
Well, the reason why I ask that is because it brings up almost a stigma. It brings up almost a thought process that is, it's unfortunate too, But, you know, we particularly as Americans, a number of Americans I asked that question to come back and they said, you know, when we first heard about the explosion, I thought it was Al-Qaeda that they were mad at Norway for being involved in Iraq or being involved in Afghanistan. Unfortunately, now we've come to a time where every time there is an act of terrorism of any scale, whether it's, you know, a bombing of an office in the bombing of an office in Oslo, or it's, you know, the events in 9/11, it's almost like we have to take a step back and we have to say, well, tell me it's not a Muslim, because that's the first thing that comes to our mind. And it's unfortunate because now Muslims have to sit there and take a step back every time they go, please don't let it be us, please don't let it be us. And I don't think that's fair. Al, you were going to make a comment?
No, it's not fair. But the lesson is don't jump to conclusions without information. I can remember clearly the day John Kennedy was assassinated. And there had been a lot of unrest, particularly down in Texas, from the right wing. And it was either Adlai Stevenson or Lyndon Johnson that was hit by a campaign sign, and you know, there was a lot of nasty stuff going on. And my reaction was, oh, those goddamn conservatives. Well, it turns out to be a pseudo-communist left-wing crazy man. And I remember Eric Severide coming on CBS and saying, we do not know, do not jump to conclusions, stay calm, we'll find out this time, but do not jump to conclusions. And I think that from my experience in that, with the Kennedy assassination, I tend to always say, wait, we'll get more information before I make judgments like that, and I think that's good advice for everybody.
And Justin, I think... The scary thing that's come out of this is he claims that there are other people that are going to follow in his footsteps under this crazy notion that they're on a mission to save European Christendom from the tide of Islam. What? Now, Norway, as we know, does not have the death penalty. So the maximum that this gentleman, Brevik, can get is 21 years. But what people don't realize is at the end of the 21 years, they can elect to extend the sentence beyond that period of time. And I think there's been such mass outrage at his actions that I think he's going to be in prison basically till the day he dies. The other issue that you have to bring up is the issue of gun control. Now, in Norway, the police do not carry weapons. This is very similar to Europe. To England in the 50s, where the police did not carry guns, but they carried sticks, they carried clubs, until you had the situation where the Krays, who were professional bank robbers, started holding up banks and killing people and shooting police at point range. Then laws were changed, and the British police were allowed to carry guns. It's going to be very interesting to see in Norway if the legislature is going to empower the police to be able to carry guns to prevent any kind of future attacks like this from happening.
Yeah, well, you know, the one item that needs to be brought up, though, is on a larger scale than gun control is the issue of homegrown terrorism. Is, you know, this is obviously a homegrown terrorist. This is obviously somebody who is very much a nationalist. This is somebody who is very much right of right wing, to the point that this is a person that invoked violence. Now we've heard about homegrown terrorism. We've been victims here in the United States, namely Timothy McVeigh and the Oklahoma City bombings. Should this be a wake up call, Al, to the American government to start looking at what should be, or the idea of homegrown terrorism? I mean, if it can happen in a country that has, on average, 40 homicides a year, which 40 homicides, that's a month in D.C., if you're talking about 40 homicides a year, and there can be homegrown terrorism there. Is that something that we need to start focusing on again back here in the U.S., Al?
Well, the first thing I would say is to suggest that had Norway had guns, this wouldn't have happened is ridiculous. How do you defend with a pistol or any kind of a gun a bomb outside a building? And then secondly, are you talking about arming children that are at this retreat? It's ludicrous. I think that
you could shoot the guy dead with the gun. That's what you.
Well, let's say I understand that, and I don't want to get into the topic of gun control right now. That's a whole other show.
But I
see where you're going at.
Pardon, I'm sorry.
I see where you're going, Al. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to make clear that I don't just for more guns. Now, your question was, is this something that civilized societies need to take seriously? Of course, but what do you do about it? You could set up a police state, possibly. I mean, already people my age can remember when you used to just go buy a ticket and get on an airplane. Now we go through all that stuff. There's a limit to what you can do to have individual freedom in a society and still do protection from these kinds of guys. And they're crazy. They're unpredictable. There may be some kinds of security that I'm not privy to that would give you greater surveillance of potential crazy people, but beyond that, I don't think there's a lot one can do.
Bob, my point is that the law enforcement, the police officers, should be empowered to carry the weapons to protect the citizenry. As I pointed out in Britain, that was not the case until the craze, these professional bank robbers, started gunning down innocent people, including police officers who had no protection when they tried to arrest the craze.
Ralph, I understand that.
Yeah.
My point is police having guns wouldn't have prevented this.
Well, no. And, you know, we hear that all the time. But gun control is such a slippery issue. I will tell you right now, since we've already come out of the hat on this one, is, you know, as former law enforcement, I carried a gun for a good part of my life. I do not own a gun now. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think that if I have to worry about defending myself and my family and my home, if I have to rely on just a gun, then that is a sad statement on society. I choose not to own a gun. Now then, do I take away the right of everybody else to own a gun? No, that is just a personal decision, a personal choice on my part. But I want to go back, and Bob, I want to go with you before we go into our final segment. I want to go back to the question of homegrown terrorism. Norway has largely been looked at as a very peaceful, a very civil society. When we see a homegrown terrorist like this gentleman in Oslo, this Breznik, when we see that, Bob, should we start paying attention more and more to inside our borders as far as homegrown terrorism goes versus keeping our eye on a Muslim ball?
Justin, I think that we already are doing a great deal of number of things that the average citizen is not aware of. I think we are, we have, as an example, we have cameras in a great many public places in a great many of our cities. We have security on at our airports. We have the Homeland Security people who are obviously keeping, and the CIA and other agencies, the FBI, that have domestic right to protect us domestically, doing a whole lot of things that we're not as normal, as everyday citizens, we're not fully aware of, and it's just as well we're not, because if we were aware of them, maybe the bad guys would be aware of them too. So I think we're probably doing about as much as we ought to be doing, And I would throw the old bromide out. You know, it, you know, we don't have too many problems of terrorism in this country, which seems to me to indicate that we must be doing something right. And what we do see from time to time, places where the FBI's counterintelligence group has, you know, foiled one plot or another. So I think we're doing pretty well right now. I would not think that the public ought to believe that the Homeland Security operations, the FBI operations for internal security, I think we're doing a pretty good job.
Well, that's a good point, Bob. That's a very good point.
The other interesting point I was going to just mention is that, will this attack cause Norway to revisit their anti-terrorism laws and make it easier to start profiling and taking a look into homegrown terrorism through a Patriot Act kind of a law that would get passed?
Well, that too is interesting. We can go into Patriot Act all day long on that one too. I think that's going to be a topic for another show, Ralph. But we've got about 10 minutes left, and I want to switch to a more lighter topic, and that is our weekly Tell Me a Story topic. This is a segment in the show where we go around the table and we can bring in gossip, rumor, hearsay, and break it out for the public, and we can break news sometimes, or sometimes we just break down. But usually it's good stuff, it's good fodder for next week's discussions, but needless to say, it is time for Tell Me a Story. I'm going to start off with Al. Al, tell me a story.
By God, you won't believe this, but I have a story.
Wow.
This week.
Hold
and,
me back.
But I want to preface it with the fact that I'm glad this show is in 3 hours because my left arm and my left ear have had about all of this that it can take.
Al, for me, it's on the right
side. And if there's any truth to the fact that cell phones cause brain cancer, I expect to be diagnosed with such within about 10 days.
God forbid, Al. God forbid.
I also want to introduce Alan Moore, a friend of mine, and I want.
Hey, Al, you broke up.
Hello,
everybody. I don't
know if I can be heard. Oh, why? But, what's the matter?
You broke up. You're introducing who?
Alan Moore, and he is one of the guys that just. And it just, yeah, we're both.
Hello,
Bob
Alan.
Bob and I are friends.
Hello, Bob.
Can
wow.
you hear Alan? Do you need to?
Yes, I
do. He's a call in. Do you need to switch something there?
Hello, Alan. How are you?
Hey, I'm fine. He's not getting through, is he?
Wait a minute. We can bring in. Alan, is that you on the 703 number?
No, the 703 number, yeah.
Alan, welcome to the show. Welcome to Backroom Politics.
Well, thanks very much. It's fun being here in the cigar-filled room. There aren't many of those in Washington anymore.
Well, sorry, we couldn't be there. We'll be there next week. If you're around, we'd love to have you join us next week.
I will do my best to come by.
Alan, I think you're a marvel to get down there. I should have made it myself. With both you and Al there, I could have had a ball. I'm sorry I didn't get there.
Not at all.
We'll do it next week.
We will do it next week. So
yeah.
Anyway,
okay.
Al, you had a story.
Yes.
Tell me a story.
My story is that the Tea Party will, in fact, allow the nation to crash and burn, that they will ultimately be the primary reason that we're not able to get the compromise we need, and there you have it.
Wow.
How is that a story?
All right.
Oh, and Alan too is a Democrat. Oh, good. Bob, tell me a story.
I'm actually not a Democrat. I'm just calling out. That wasn't a story. That was a prediction.
Good for you, Alan.
Very good, Alan.
I don't have to agree with it.
Yeah.
Bob, tell me a story.
Last week, I said that I believed that Rick Perry was probably likely to get in to the Republican race for the nomination for presidency. I think that's even more true right now. In about 10 days, I think they have that straw poll in Ames, Iowa, which is more, you know, crazy than it is reality. But if you take a look at the Republican nominee for president race, you don't see anybody really catching on. The Honorable Mr. Romney continues to lead. Ms. Bachman is relatively close behind him. And everybody else is so far down, you can hardly see him with a telescope. You know, it's if you're a Republican, as I am, it's disappointing. I don't know a great deal about the politics of the governor of Texas. He has certainly been successful in developing jobs. I think half the net jobs in the country that have been increased in the last year and a half have been in Texas. That's got to mean he knows something about what he's doing, but I don't know exactly what it is. And I don't know enough about him to know what kind of a president he would make. But it seems to me that it's so wide open that if he does decide to get in, he's bound to be pretty popular pretty quickly, because it's clear that the public, and particularly the Republicans, are not very happy with what they've got now.
Wow. Do you think he'll announce this month, or is he going to wait until
I think he's got some meeting he's got to go to in the middle of August that I think he's trying to get behind him before he announces. So I'm saying it's probably 3 weeks away.
Okay. Interesting.
In fairness, to Al, that was no more of a story than Al has. That was just another prediction.
All right.
Well, we got to put Alan on mute.
I never did like Alan. I want you to know that.
But, Ralph, tell me a story.
Okay. Keep an eye on Josh Mandel. He's 33 years old. He's running for Senate in Ohio and against Sherrod Brown. He's outraged Sherrod Brown by 80,000. He's endorsed by Jim DeMint and the Tea Party. But interestingly enough, he's got endorsements from moderate Republicans, including former Governor Linda Lingle from Hawaii. Keep an eye on Josh Mandel.
Wow. You think he's going to take that junior senator's seat in Hawaii?
Keep an eye on him. He's one of the few candidates in the Republican Party that has the endorsement of Jim DeMint, Tea Party, as well as moderate Republicans.
Wow, interesting, very interesting. Has he gotten the endorsement of Scott Brown?
I don't think so yet, but just keep an eye on him.
Okay, very good, very good.
He's a candidate that's on the move.
Interesting, interesting. Okay, well, that covers, tell me a story. We will be back next week. I will be back in town next week, and we will do this broadcast again live from Shelley's back room. Hey, you know what? Once in a while, it just proves that technology works. All of us stayed on. We didn't lose a signal. I got to tell you, I'm very happy. To Ralph, to Bob, and to Al, I want to thank you guys for staying on for 2 hours. I know, Bob, your right arm is tired. I know, Al, your left arm is tired.
Right.
I think that's nothing that a martini and a glass of wine won't fix. Ralph, I don't know
what arm.
I'm
working on it, you know.
Ralph, I don't know what arm is tired on you.
Justin, I wanted to just say on behalf of the group, we really love you. So you're doing a fabulous job.
Well, thanks. Appreciate it, guys. All right, that's enough.
I know a brown nose when I hear one.
Just wait till we're back next week, Al. I'll get you in the headlock.
So, anyway, if Ralph has gone to headlock mode, that means it's time to call it a day. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Ralph Winnie, Bob Hines, Congressman Al Swift, I'm your moderator, J.T. Russell. We'll be back next Tuesday at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, America's premier cigar tavern, for Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. We appreciate your calling in, and we appreciate your support. We'll talk to you next Tuesday. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.